is, contrary to the claims made by certain unreliable webcomics. But TV and radio transmissions still weren't Earth's most powerful radio signal. They were outshone by the beams from early warning radar. Early warning radar, a product of the Cold War, consisted of a bunch of ground and airborne stations scattered around the Arctic. These stations swept the atmosphere with powerful radar beams, 24/7, often bouncing them off the ionosphere, and people obsessively monitored the echoes for any hints of enemy movement. I wasn't alive during most of this period, but from what I hear, the mood was tense. These radar transmissions leaked into space, and could probably be picked up by nearby exoplanets if they happened to be listening when the beam swept over their part of the sky. But the same march of technological progress that made the TV broadcast towers obsolete has had the same effect on early warning radar. Today's systems, where they exist at all, are much quieter and may eventually be replaced completely by new technology. Sir, the enemy has launched a missile. How do you know? Twitter. Earth's most powerful radio signal is the beam from the Arecibo telescope. This massive dish in Puerto Rico can function as a radar transmitter, bouncing a signal off nearby targets like Mercury and the asteroid belt. It's essentially a flashlight that we shine on planets to see them better. This is just as crazy as it sounds. However, it transmits only occasionally and in a narrow beam. If an exoplanet happened to be caught in the beam, and they were lucky enough to be pointing a receiving antenna at our corner of the sky at the time, all they would pick up would be a brief pulse of radio energy, then silence, which is exactly what we saw once in 1977. The source of this blip, dubbed the WOW signal, has never been identified. So hypothetical aliens looking at Earth probably wouldn't pick us up with radio antennas. But there's also visible light. This is more promising. The sun is really bright, citation needed, and its light illuminates the Earth, citation needed. Some of that light is reflected back into space as Earthshine. Some of it skims close to our planet and passes through our atmosphere before continuing on to the stars. Both of these effects could potentially be detected from an exoplanet. They wouldn't tell you anything about humans directly, but if you watched the Earth for long enough, you could figure out a lot about our atmosphere from the reflectivity. You could probably figure out what our water cycle looked like, and our oxygen-rich atmosphere would give you a hint that something weird was going on. So, in the end, the clearest signal from Earth might not be from us at all. It might be from the algae that have been terraforming the planet and altering the signals we send into space for billions of years. Of course, if we wanted to send a clearer signal, we could. A radio transmission has the problem that they have to be paying attention when it arrives. Instead, we could make them pay attention. With ion drives, nuclear propulsion, or just clever use of the sun's gravity well, we could probably send a probe out of the solar system fast enough to reach a given nearby star in a few dozen millennia. If we can figure out how to make a guidance system that survives the trip, which would be tough, we could use it to steer toward any inhabited planet. To land safely, we'd have to slow down. But slowing down takes even more fuel, and hey, the whole point of this was for them to notice us, right? Chapter 24. No More DNA. Question. This may be a bit gruesome, but if someone's DNA suddenly vanished, how long would that person last? Nina Cherist. Answer. If you lost your DNA, you would instantly be about a third of a pound lighter. Losing a third of a pound. I don't recommend this strategy. There are easier ways to lose a third of a pound, including taking off your shirt, peeing, cutting your hair if you have very long hair, donating blood but putting a kink in the IV once they drain 150 milliliters and refusing to let them take any more, holding a 3-foot diameter balloon full of helium, removing your fingers. You'll also lose a third of a pound if you take a trip from the polar regions to the tropics. This happens for two reasons. One, the Earth isn't a perfect sphere. It's slightly, slightly pancake-shaped. If you stand on the North Pole, you're 20 kilometers closer to the center of the Earth than if you stand on the equator, and you feel a stronger pull from gravity. Furthermore, if you're on the equator, you're being flung outward by centrifugal force. Yes, centrifugal, I will fight you. The result of these two phenomena is that if you move between polar regions and equatorial ones, you might lose or gain up to about 0.5% of your body weight. The reason I'm focusing on weight is that if your DNA disappeared, the physical loss of the matter wouldn't be the first thing you might notice. It's possible you'd feel something, a tiny uniform shockwave as every cell contracted slightly, but maybe not. If you were standing up when you lost your DNA, you might twitch slightly. When you stand, your muscles are constantly working to keep you upright. The force being exerted by those muscle fibers wouldn't change, but the mass they're pulling on, your limbs, would. Since force equals mass times acceleration, various body parts would accelerate slightly. After that, you would probably feel pretty normal. For a while. Destroying Angel. Nobody has ever lost all their DNA. I don't have a citation for this, but I feel like we would have heard about it. So we can't say for sure what the precise sequence of medical consequences would be. But to get an idea of what it might be like, let's turn to mushroom poisonings. Amanita bisporigera is a species of mushroom found in eastern North America. Along with related species in America and Europe, it's known by the common name Destroying Angel. Destroying Angel is a small, white, innocuous-looking mushroom. If you're like me, you were told never to eat mushrooms you found in the woods. Amanita is the reason why. There are several members of the Amanita genus called Destroying Angel. And along with another Amanita called Deathcap, they are responsible for the vast majority of fatal mushroom poisonings. If you eat a destroying angel, for the rest of the day you'll feel fine. Later that night or the next morning, you'll start exhibiting cholera-like symptoms, vomiting, abdominal pain, and severe diarrhea. Then you start to feel better. At the point where you start to feel better, the damage is probably irreversible. Amanita mushrooms contain amatoxin, which binds to an enzyme that is used to read information from DNA. It hobbles the enzyme, effectively interrupting the process by which cells follow DNA's instructions. Amatoxin causes irreversible damage to whatever cells it collects in. Since most of your body is made of cells, citation, I got one of your friends to sneak into your room with a microscope while you were sleeping and check, this is bad. Death is generally caused by liver or kidney failure, since those are the first sensitive organs in which the toxin accumulates. Sometimes intensive care and a liver transplant can be enough to save a patient, but a sizable percentage of those who eat Amanita mushrooms die. The frightening thing about Amanita poisoning is the walking ghost phase, the period where you seem to be fine or getting better, but your cells are accumulating irreversible and lethal damage. This pattern is typical of DNA damage, and we'd likely see something like it in someone who lost their DNA. The picture is even more vividly illustrated by two other examples of DNA damage, chemotherapy and radiation. Radiation and chemotherapy. Chemotherapy drugs are blunt instruments. Some are more precisely targeted than others, but many simply interrupt cell division in general. The reason that this selectively kills cancer cells instead of harming the patient and the cancer equally is that cancer cells are dividing all the time, whereas most normal cells divide only occasionally. Some human cells do divide constantly. The most rapidly dividing cells are found in the bone marrow, the factory that produces blood. Bone marrow is also central to the human immune system. Without it, we lose the ability to produce white blood cells and our immune system collapses. Chemotherapy causes damage to the immune system, which makes cancer patients vulnerable to stray infections. Immune boosters like pegfilgrastim, Neulasta, make frequent doses of chemotherapy safer. They stimulate white blood cell production by, in effect, tricking the body into thinking that it has a massive E. coli infection that it needs to fight off. There are other types of rapidly dividing cells in the body. Our hair follicles and stomach lining also divide constantly, which is why chemotherapy can cause hair loss and nausea. Doxorubicin, one of the most common and potent chemotherapy drugs, works by linking random segments of DNA to one another to tangle them. This is like dripping superglue on a ball of yarn. It binds the DNA into a useless tangle, although it's a little different. If you drip superglue on cotton thread, it will catch fire. The initial side effects of doxorubicin in the few days after treatment are nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, which makes sense since the drug kills cells in the digestive tract. A loss of DNA would cause similar cell death and probably similar symptoms. Radiation. Large doses of gamma radiation also harm you by damaging your DNA. Radiation poisoning is probably the kind of real-life injury that most resembles Nina's scenario. The cells most sensitive to radiation are, as with chemotherapy, those in your bone marrow, followed by those in your digestive tract. Extremely high radiation doses kill people quickly, but not because of DNA damage. Instead, they physically dissolve the blood-brain barrier, resulting in rapid death from cerebral hemorrhage, brain bleeding. Radiation poisoning, like destroying angel mushroom toxicity, has a latent period, a walking ghost phase. This is the period where the body is still working, but no new proteins can be synthesized, and the immune system is collapsing. In cases of severe radiation poisoning, the immune system collapse is the primary cause of death. Without a supply of white blood cells, the body can't fight off infections, and ordinary bacteria can get into the body and run wild. The end result. Losing your DNA would most likely result in abdominal pain, nausea, dizziness, rapid immune system collapse, and death within days or hours from either rapid systemic infection or system-wide organ failure. On the other hand, there would be at least one silver lining. If we ever end up in a dystopian future where Orwellian governments collect our genetic information and use it to track and control us, you'd be invisible. Chapter 25, Interplanetary Cessna. Question: what would happen if you tried to fly a normal Earth airplane above different solar system bodies? Glenn Chiacchieri. Answer: for our aircraft, we'll use a Cessna propeller plane, refitted with an electric motor and a fuel tank stuffed with lithium-ion batteries. The Cessna 172 Skyhawk, probably the most common plane in the world. We have to use an electric motor because gas engines work only near green plants. On worlds without plants, oxygen doesn't stay in the atmosphere. It combines with other elements to form things like carbon dioxide and rust. Plants undo this by stripping the oxygen back out and pumping it into the air. Engines need oxygen in the air to run. Also, our gasoline is made of ancient plants. Let's imagine what would happen if we launched our aircraft, along with its reluctant pilot, above various solar system bodies. Unfortunately, most of those bodies have no atmosphere, so our plane would drop like a rock and crash. In most cases, there's no atmosphere, and the plane would fall straight to the ground. If it were dropped from 1 kilometer or less, in a few cases, the crash would be slow enough that the pilot could survive, although the life support equipment probably wouldn't. There are 9 solar system bodies with atmospheres thick enough to matter. Earth, obviously, Mars, Venus, the 4 gas giants, Saturn's moon Titan, and the Sun. Let's take a closer look at what would happen to a plane on each one. The Sun. This would work about as well as you'd imagine. If the plane were released close enough to the Sun to feel its atmosphere at all, it would be vaporized in less than a second. Mars. To see what would happen to our aircraft on Mars, we turn to X-Plane. X-Plane is the most advanced flight simulator in the world, the product of 20 years of obsessive labor by a hardcore aeronautics enthusiast who uses caps lock a lot when talking about planes. And community of supporters. It actually simulates the flow of air over every piece of an aircraft's body as it flies. This makes it a valuable research tool since it can accurately simulate entirely new aircraft designs and new environments. In particular, if you change the X-Plane config file to reduce gravity, thin the atmosphere, and shrink the radius of the planet, it can simulate flight on Mars. X-Plane tells us that flight on Mars is difficult but not impossible. NASA knows this and has considered surveying Mars by airplane. The tricky thing is that with so little atmosphere to get any lift, you have to go fast. You need to approach Mach 1 just to get off the ground, and once you get moving, you have so much inertia that it's hard to change course. If you turn, your plane rotates, but keeps moving in the original direction. The X-Plane author compared piloting Martian aircraft to flying a supersonic ocean liner. Our Cessna 172 wouldn't be up to the challenge. If launched from 1 kilometer, it wouldn't build up enough speed to pull out of a dive and would plow into the Martian terrain at over 60 meters per second, 135 miles per hour. If dropped from 4 or 5 kilometers, it could gain enough speed to pull up into a glide at over half the speed of sound. The landing would not be survivable. Venus. Unfortunately, X-Plane is not capable of simulating the hellish environment near the surface of Venus, but physics calculations give us an idea of what flight there would be like. The upshot is, your plane would fly pretty well, except it would be on fire the whole time, and then it would stop flying, and then stop being a plane. The atmosphere on Venus is over 60 times denser than Earth's. It's thick enough that a Cessna moving at jogging speed would rise into the air. Unfortunately, that air is hot enough to melt lead. The paint would start melting off in seconds, the plane's components would fail rapidly, and the plane would glide gently into the ground as it came apart under the heat stress. A much better bet would be to fly above the clouds. While Venus's surface is awful, its upper atmosphere is surprisingly Earth-like. At 55 kilometers, a human could survive with an oxygen mask and a protective wetsuit. The air is room temperature, and the pressure is similar to that on Earth mountains. You would need a wetsuit, though, to protect you from the sulfuric acid. I'm not selling this well, am I? The acid's no fun, but it turns out that the area right above the clouds is a great environment for an aeroplane, as long as it has no exposed metal to be corroded away by the sulfuric acid, and is capable of flight in constant Category 5 hurricane-level winds, which are another thing I forgot to mention earlier. Venus is a terrible place. Jupiter. Our Cessna wouldn't be able to fly on Jupiter. The gravity is just too strong. The power needed to maintain level flight under Jupiter's gravity is 3 times greater than that on Earth. Starting from a friendly sea-level pressure, we'd accelerate through the tumbling winds into a 275 meters per second, 600 miles per hour, downward glide deeper and deeper through the layers of ammonia ice and water ice until we and the aircraft were crushed. There's no surface to hit. Jupiter transitions smoothly from gas to liquid as you sink deeper and deeper. Saturn. The picture here is a little friendlier than on Jupiter. The weaker gravity, close to Earth's actually, and slightly denser but still thin atmosphere mean that we'd be able to struggle along a bit further before we gave in to either the cold or high winds and descended to the same fate as on Jupiter. Uranus. Uranus is a strange, uniform, bluish orb. There are high winds, and it's bitterly cold. It's the friendliest of the gas giants to our Cessna, and you could probably fly for a little while. But given that it seems to be an almost completely featureless planet, why would you want to? Neptune. If you're going to fly around one of the ice giants, I would probably recommend Neptune, motto, the slightly bluer one, over Uranus. It at least has some clouds to look at before you freeze to death or break apart from the turbulence. Titan. We've saved the best for last. When it comes to flying, Titan might be better than Earth. Its atmosphere is thick, but its gravity is light, giving it a surface pressure only 50% higher than Earth's, with air 4 times as dense. Its gravity, lower than that of the Moon, means that flying is easy. Our Cessna could get into the air under pedal power. In fact, humans on Titan could fly by muscle power. A human in a hang glider could comfortably take off and cruise around powered by oversized swim flipper boots, or even take off by flapping artificial wings. The power requirements are minimal. It would probably take no more effort than walking. The downside, there's always a downside, is the cold. It's 72 Kelvin on Titan, which is about the temperature of liquid nitrogen. Judging from some numbers on heating requirements for light aircraft, I estimate that the cabin of a Cessna on Titan would probably cool by about 2 degrees per minute. The batteries would help to keep themselves warm for a little while, but eventually the craft would run out of heat and crash. The Huygens probe, which descended with batteries nearly drained, taking fascinating pictures as it fell, succumbed to the cold after only a few hours on the surface. It had enough time to send back a single photo after landing, the only one we have of the surface of a body beyond Mars. If humans put on artificial wings to fly, we might become titanian versions of the Icarus story. Our wings could freeze, fall apart, and send us tumbling to our deaths. But I've never seen the Icarus story as a lesson about the limitations of humans. I see it as a lesson about the limitations of wax as an adhesive. The cold of Titan is just an engineering problem. With the right refitting and the right heat sources, a Cessna 172 could fly on Titan, and so could we. Weird and worrying questions from the What If inbox, number 6. Question. What is the total nutritional value, calories, fat, vitamins, minerals, etc., of the average human body? Justin Reisner. I need to know by Friday. Shh, here he comes. Question. What temperature would a chainsaw or other cutting implement need to be at to instantly cauterize any injuries inflicted with it? Sylvia Gallagher. I need to know by Friday. Chapter 26. Yoda. Question. How much force power can Yoda output? Ryan Finney. Answer. I'm going to, of course, ignore the prequels. Yoda's greatest display of raw power in the original trilogy came when he lifted Luke's X-Wing from the swamp. As far as physically moving objects around goes, this was easily the biggest expenditure of energy through the Force we saw from anyone in the trilogy. The energy it takes to lift an object to a given height is equal to the object's mass times the force of gravity times the height it's lifted. The X-Wing scene lets us use this to put a lower limit on Yoda's peak power output. First, we need to know how heavy the ship was. The X-Wing's mass has never been canonically established, but its length has, 12.5 meters. An F-22 is 19 meters long and weighs 19,700 kilograms, so scaling down from this gives an estimate for the X-Wing of about 12,000 pounds, 5 metric tons. Next, we need to know how fast it was rising. I went over footage of the scene and timed the X-Wing's rate of ascent as it was emerging from the water. The front landing strut rises out of the water in about 3.5 seconds, and I estimated the strut to be 1.4 meters long, based on a scene in A New Hope where a crew member squeezes past it, which tells us the X-Wing was rising at 0.39 meters per second. Lastly, we need to know the strength of gravity on Dagobah. Here, I figure I'm stuck, because while sci-fi fans are obsessive, it's not like there's going to be a catalog of minor geophysical characteristics for every planet visited in Star Wars, right? Nope, I've underestimated the fandom. Wikipedia has just such a catalog and informs us that the surface gravity on Dagobah is 0.9 g. Combining this with the X-Wing mass and lift rate gives us our peak power output. 5,600 kilograms times 0.9 g times 1.4 meters divided by 3.6 seconds equals 19.2 kilowatts. That's enough to power a block of suburban homes. It's also equal to about 25 horsepower, which is about the power of the motor in the electric model smart car. At current electricity prices, Yoda would be worth about $2 an hour. But telekinesis is just one type of force power. What about that lightning the Emperor used to zap Luke? The physical nature of it is never made clear, but Tesla coils that produce similar displays draw something like 10 kilowatts, which would put the Emperor roughly on par with Yoda. Those Tesla coils typically use lots of very short pulses. If the Emperor is sustaining a continuous arc, as in an arc welder, the power could easily be in the megawatts. What about Luke? I examine the scene where he used his nascent force powers to yank his lightsaber out of the snow. The numbers are harder to estimate here, but I went through frame by frame and came up with an estimate of 400 watts for his peak output. This is a fraction of Yoda's 19 kilowatts and was sustained for only a fraction of a second. So, Yoda sounds like our best bet as an energy source. But with world electricity consumption pushing 2 terawatts, it would take 100 million Yodas to meet our demands. All things considered, switching to Yoda power probably isn't worth the trouble. Though it would definitely be green. Chapter 27, Flyover States. Which U.S. state is actually flown over the most? Jesse Ruderman. Answer. When people say flyover states, they're usually referring to the big square states out west that people stereotypically cross over while flying between New York, L.A., and Chicago, but don't actually land in. But what state do the largest number of planes actually fly over? There are a lot of flights up and down the East Coast. It would be easy to imagine that people fly over New York more often than Wyoming. To figure out what the real flyover states are, I looked at over 10,000 air traffic routes, determining which states each flight passed over. Surprisingly, the state with the most planes flying over it, without taking off or landing, is Virginia. This result surprised me. I grew up in Virginia, and I certainly never thought of it as a flyover state. It's surprising because Virginia has several major airports. Two of the airports serving D.C. are actually located in Virginia, DCA Reagan and IAD Dulles. This means most flights to D.C. don't count toward flights over Virginia, since those flights land in Virginia. Close behind Virginia are Maryland, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. These states have substantially more daily flyovers than any other. So why Virginia? There are a number of factors, but one of the biggest is Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport. Atlanta's airport is the busiest in the world, with more passengers and flights than Tokyo, London, Beijing, Chicago, or Los Angeles. It's the main hub airport for Delta Airlines, until recently the world's largest airline, which means passengers taking Delta flights will often connect through Atlanta. Thanks to the large volume of flights from Atlanta to the Northeast U.S., 20% of all Atlanta flights cross Virginia and 25% cross North Carolina, contributing substantially to the totals for each state. However, Atlanta isn't the biggest contributor to Virginia's totals. The airport with the most flights over Virginia was a surprise to me. Toronto Pearson International Airport, YYZ, seems an unlikely source of Virginia crossing flights, but Canada's largest airport contributes more flights over Virginia than New York's JFK and LaGuardia airports combined. Part of the reason for Toronto's dominance is that it has many direct flights to the Caribbean and South America, which cross U.S. airspace on the way to their destinations. It helps that Canada, unlike the U.S., has extensive commercial flight service to Cuba. In addition to Virginia, Toronto is also the chief source of flights over West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and New York. Flyover states by ratio. Another possible definition of flyover state is the state that has the highest ratio of flights over it to flights to it. By this measure, the flyover states are, for the most part, simply the least dense states. The top 10 include, predictably, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, Idaho, and the Dakotas. The state with the highest ratio of flights over to flights to, however, is a surprise, Delaware. A little digging turned up the very straightforward reason. Delaware has no airports. Now, that's not quite true. Delaware has a number of airfields, including Dover Air Force Base, DOV, and Newcastle Airport, ILG. Newcastle Airport is the only one that might qualify as a commercial airport, but after Skybus Airlines shut down in 2008, the airport had no airlines serving it. This changed in 2013, when Frontier Airlines began operating a route between Newcastle Airport and Fort Myers, Florida. This wasn't included in my data set, and it's possible Frontier will bump Delaware down the list. Least flown over state. The least flown over state is Hawaii, which makes sense. It consists of tiny islands in the middle of the world's biggest ocean. You have to try pretty hard to hit it. Of the 49 non-island states, I'm including Rhode Island here, though it seems wrong to, The least flown over state is California. This came as a surprise to me since California is long and skinny, and it seems like a lot of flights over the Pacific would need to pass over it. However, since jet fuel-laden planes were used as weapons on 9/11, the FAA has tried to limit the number of unnecessarily fuel-heavy flights crossing the U.S., so most international travelers who might otherwise travel over California instead take a connecting flight from one of the airports there. Fly under states. Lastly, let's answer a slightly stranger question. What's the most flown under state? That is, what state has the most flights on the opposite side of the Earth pass directly under its territory? The answer turns out to be Hawaii. The reason such a tiny state wins in this category is that most of the U.S. is opposite the Indian Ocean, which has very few commercial flights over it. Hawaii, on the other hand, is opposite Botswana in Central Africa. Africa doesn't have a high volume of flights over it compared to most other continents, but it's enough to win Hawaii the top spot. Poor Virginia. As someone who grew up there, it's hard for me to accept Virginia's status as the most flown over state. If nothing else, when I'm back home with family, I'll try to remember, once in a while, to look up and wave. And if you find yourself on Eric Air Flight 104 from Johannesburg, South Africa, to Lagos, Nigeria, daily service departing at 9:35 a.m., remember to look down and say aloha. Chapter 28, Falling with Helium. Question. What if I jumped out of an airplane with a couple of tanks of helium and one huge, uninflated balloon? Then, while falling, I release the helium and fill the balloon. How long of a fall would I need in order for the balloon to slow me enough that I could land safely? Colin Rowe. Answer. As ridiculous as it sounds, this is, sort of, plausible. Falling from great heights is dangerous, citation needed. A balloon could actually help save you, although a regular helium one from a party obviously won't do the trick. If the balloon is large enough, you don't even need the helium. A balloon will act as a parachute, slowing your fall to non-fatal speeds. Avoiding a high-speed landing is, unsurprisingly, the key to survival. As one medical paper put it, it is of course obvious that speed or height of fall is not in itself injurious, but a high rate of change of velocity, such as occurs after a 10-story fall onto concrete, is another matter. Which is just a wordy version of the old saying, it's not the fall that kills you, it's the sudden stop at the end. To act as a parachute, a balloon filled with air, rather than helium, would have to be 10 to 20 meters across, far too big to be inflated with portable tanks. A powerful fan could be used to fill it with ambient air, but at that point you may as well just use a parachute. Helium. The helium makes things easier. It doesn't take too many helium balloons to lift a person. In 1982, Larry Walters flew across Los Angeles in a lawn chair lifted by weather balloons, eventually reaching several miles in altitude. After passing through LAX airspace, he descended by shooting some of the balloons with a pellet gun. On landing, Walters was arrested, although the authorities had some trouble figuring out what to charge him with. At the time, an FAA safety inspector told the New York Times, "We know he broke some part of the Federal Aviation Act, and as soon as we decide which part it is, some type of charge will be filed." A relatively small helium balloon, certainly smaller than a parachute, will suffice to slow your fall, but it still has to be huge by party balloon standards. The biggest consumer rental helium tanks are about 250 cubic feet, and you would need to empty at least 10 of them to put enough air in the balloon to support your weight. You'd have to do it quickly. Compressed helium cylinders are smooth and often quite heavy, which means they have a high terminal velocity. You'll have only a few minutes to use up all the cylinders. As soon as you emptied one, you could drop it. You can't get around this problem by moving your starting point higher. As we learned from the Stake incident, since the upper atmosphere is pretty thin, anything dropped from the stratosphere or higher will accelerate to very high speeds until it hits the lower atmosphere, then fall slowly the rest of the way. This is true of everything from small meteors to Felix Baumgartner. While researching impact speeds for this answer, I came across a discussion on the Straight Dope message board about survivable fall heights. One poster compared a fall from height to being hit by a bus. Another user, a medical examiner, replied that this was a bad comparison. When hit by a car, the vast majority of people are not run over. They are run under. The lower legs break, sending them into the air. They usually strike the hood of the car, often with the back of the head impacting the windshield, starring the windshield, possibly leaving a few hairs in the glass. They then go over the top of the car. They are still alive, although with broken legs and maybe with head pain from the non-fatal windshield impact. They die when they hit the ground. They die from head injury. The lesson? Don't mess with medical examiners. They're apparently pretty hardcore. But if you inflated the balloons quickly, possibly by connecting many canisters to it at once, you'd be able to slow your fall. Just don't use too much helium, or you'll end up floating at 16,000 feet like Larry Walters. While researching this answer, I managed to lock up my copy of Mathematica several times on balloon-related differential equations, and subsequently got my IP address banned from Wolfram Alpha for making too many requests. The ban appeal form asked me to explain what task I was performing that necessitated so many queries. I replied, calculating how many rental helium tanks you'd have to carry with you in order to inflate a balloon large enough to act as a parachute and slow your fall from a jet aircraft. Chapter 29. Everybody out. Question. Is there enough energy to move the entire current human population off-planet? Adam. Answer. There are a bunch of science fiction movies where, because of pollution, overpopulation, or nuclear war, humanity abandons Earth. But lifting people into space is hard. Barring a massive reduction in the population, is launching the whole human race into space physically possible? Let's not even worry about where we're headed. We'll assume we don't have to find a new home, but we can't stay here. To figure out if this is plausible, we can start with an absolute baseline energy requirement. 4 gigajoules per person. No matter how we do it, whether we use rockets or a cannon or a space elevator or a ladder, moving a 65-kilogram person, or 65 kilograms of anything, out of the Earth's gravity well requires at least this much energy. How much is 4 gigajoules? It's about a megawatt hour, which is what a typical U.S. household consumes in electricity in a month or two. It's equal to the amount of stored energy in 90 kilograms of gasoline or a cargo van full of AA batteries. 4 gigajoules times 7 billion people gives us 2.8 times 10 to the 18th joules, or 8 petawatt hours. This is about 5% of the world's annual energy consumption. A lot, but not physically implausible. However, 4 gigajoules is just a minimum. In practice, everything would depend on our means of transportation. If we were using rockets, for example, it would take a lot more energy than that. This is because of a fundamental problem with rockets. They have to lift their own fuel. Let's return for a moment to those 90 kilograms of gasoline, about 30 gallons, because they help illustrate this central problem in space travel. If we want to launch a 65-kilogram spaceship, we need the energy of around 90 kilograms of fuel. We load that fuel on board, and now our spaceship weighs 155 kilograms. A 155-kilogram spaceship requires 215 kilograms of fuel. So we load another 125 kilograms on board. Fortunately, we're saved from an infinite loop where we add 1.3 kilograms for every 1 kilogram we add by the fact that we don't have to carry that fuel all the way up. We burn it as we go, so we get lighter and lighter, which means we need less and less fuel. But we do have to lift the fuel part way. The formula for how much propellant we need to burn to get moving at a given speed is given by the Tsiolkovsky rocket equation. Delta V equals the effective exhaust velocity times the natural logarithm of the ratio of M start to M end. M start and M end are the total mass of the ship plus the fuel before and after the burn, and V exhaust is the exhaust velocity of the fuel. a number that's between 2.5 and 4.5 kilometers per second for rocket fuels. What's important is the ratio between delta V, the speed we want to be going, and V exhaust, the speed that the propellant exits our rocket. For leaving Earth, we need a delta V of upward of 13 kilometers a second, and exhaust velocity is limited to about 4.5 kilometers per second, which gives a fuel-to-ship ratio of at least the natural logarithmic base E to the power of 13 divided by 4.5, equaling approximately 20. If that ratio is X, then to launch a kilogram of ship, we need E to the X kilograms of fuel. As X grows, this amount gets very large. The upshot is that to overcome Earth's gravity using traditional rocket fuels, a one-ton craft needs 20 to 50 tons of fuel. Launching all of humanity, total weight around 400 million tons, would therefore take tens of trillions of tons of fuel. That's a lot. If we were using hydrocarbon-based fuels, it would represent a decent chunk of the world's remaining oil reserves. And that's not even worrying about the weight of the ship itself, food, water, or our pets. There are probably around 1 million tons of pet dog in the U.S. alone. We'd also need fuel to produce all these ships, to transport people to launch sites, and so forth. It's not necessarily completely impossible, but it's certainly outside the realm of plausibility. But rockets aren't our only option. As crazy as it sounds, we might be better off trying to, one, literally climb into space on a rope, or, two, blow ourselves off the planet with nuclear weapons. These are actually serious, if audacious, ideas for launch systems, both of which have been bouncing around since the start of the space age. The first approach is the space elevator concept, a favorite of science fiction authors. The idea is that we connect a tether to a satellite orbiting far enough out that the tether is held taut by centrifugal force. Then, we can send climbers up the rope using ordinary electricity and motors powered by solar power, nuclear generators, or whatever works best. The biggest engineering hurdle is that the tether would have to be several times stronger than anything we can currently build. There are hopes that carbon nanotube-based materials could provide the required strength, adding this to the long list of engineering problems that can be waved away by tacking on the prefix nano. The second approach is nuclear pulse propulsion, a surprisingly plausible method for getting huge amounts of material moving really fast. The basic idea is that you toss a nuclear bomb behind you and ride the shockwave. You'd think the spacecraft would be vaporized, but it turns out that if it has a well-designed shield, the blast would fling away before it has a chance to disintegrate. If it could be made reliable enough, this system would, in theory, be capable of lifting entire city blocks into orbit and could, potentially, accomplish our goal. The engineering principles behind this were thought to be solid enough that in the 1960s, under the guidance of Freeman Dyson, the U.S. government actually tried to build one of these spaceships. The story of that effort, dubbed Project Orion, is detailed in the excellent book of the same name by Freeman's son, George. Advocates for nuclear pulse propulsion are still disappointed that the project was canceled before any prototypes were built. Others argue that when you think about what they were trying to do, put a gigantic nuclear arsenal in a box, hurl it high into the atmosphere, and bomb it repeatedly, it's terrifying that it got as far as it did. So the answer is that while sending one person into space is easy, getting all of us there would tax our resources to the limit and possibly destroy the planet. It's a small step for a man, but a giant leap for mankind. Weird and worrying questions from the What If inbox number 7. Question. In Thor, the main character is at one point spinning his hammer so fast that he creates a strong tornado. Would this be possible in real life? Davor. No. Question. If you saved a whole life's worth of kissing and used all that suction power on one single kiss, how much suction force would that single kiss have? Jonathan Lindstrom. Question. how many nuclear missiles would have to be launched at the United States to turn it into a complete wasteland? Anonymous. Chapter 30. Self-fertilization. Question. I read about some researchers who were trying to produce sperm from bone marrow stem cells. If a woman were to have sperm cells made from her own stem cells and impregnate herself, what would be her relationship to her daughter? R. Scott Lamort. Answer. To make a human, you need to put together two sets of DNA. In humans, these two sets are held in a sperm cell and an egg cell, each of which holds a random sample of the parent's DNA. More on how that randomization works in a moment. In humans, these cells are from two different people. However, that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. Stem cells, which can form any type of tissue, could in principle be used to produce sperm or eggs. So far, nobody has been able to produce complete sperm from stem cells. In 2007, a group of researchers succeeded in turning bone marrow stem cells into spermatogonial stem cells. These cells are the predecessors to sperm. The researchers couldn't get the cells to fully develop into sperm, but it was a step. In 2009, the same group published a paper that seemed to claim they'd made the final step and produced functioning sperm cells. There were two problems. First, they didn't actually say they had produced sperm cells. They said they produced sperm-like cells, but the media generally glossed over this. Second, the paper was retracted by the journal that published it. It turns out the authors had plagiarized two paragraphs of their article from another paper. Despite these problems, the fundamental idea here is not that far-fetched, and the answer to R. Scott's question turns out to be a little bit unsettling. Keeping track of the flow of genetic information can be pretty tricky. To help illustrate it, let's take a look at a highly simplified model that may be familiar to fans of role-playing games. Chromosomes, D&D edition. Human DNA is organized into 23 segments called chromosomes, and each person has two versions of each chromosome, one from their mother and one from their father. In our simplified version of DNA, instead of 23 chromosomes, there will be just 7. In humans, each chromosome contains a huge amount of genetic code, but in our model, each chromosome will control only one thing. We'll use a version of D&D's D20 system of character stats, in which each piece of DNA contains 7 chromosomes. Strength, constitution, dexterity, charisma, wisdom, intelligence, sex. 6 of these are the classic character stats from role-playing games. Strength, constitution, dexterity, charisma, wisdom, and intelligence. The last one is the self-determining chromosome. Here's an example DNA strand. Strength, 15. Constitution, 2. Dexterity, 1x. Charisma, 12. Wisdom, 0.5x. Intelligence, 14. Sex, x. In our model, each chromosome contains one piece of information. This piece of information is either a stat, a number, usually between 1 and 18, or a multiplier. The last one, sex, is the sex-determining chromosome, which, as with real human genetics, can be X or Y. Just like in real life, each person has two sets of chromosomes, one from their mother and one from their father. The combination of these two sets of stats determines a person's characteristics. Here's the simple rule for combining stats in our system. If you have a number for both versions of a chromosome, you get the bigger number as your stat. If you have a number on one chromosome and a multiplier on the other, your stat is the number times the multiplier. If you have a multiplier on both sides, you get a stat of 1, because 1 is the multiplicative identity. Now, each parent contributes a single strand of DNA, but the strand they contribute will be a random mix of their own two strands, which they got from their mother and father. Every time they make a sperm or egg cell, they fill each chromosome slot with a random choice from one of their two strands. When one parent contributes a multiplier and the other contributes a number, the result can be very good. If your mother contributes a 2x multiplier in the constitution spot and your father contributes a 12, your constitution would be a superhuman 24. However, if both parents happen to contribute a multiplier, the result would be a rock-bottom constitution of 1. Fortunately, since these multipliers are relatively rare, the chances of you and the other person contributing multipliers on exactly the same genes are pretty low. However, if you have a child with yourself, the random selection process is drawing from the same strands, yours, to create both the sperm and the egg. This makes it much more likely that it will give the same gene to both of them, making the chance of a double multiplier much higher. In general, if you have a child with yourself, 50% of your chromosomes will have the same stat on both sides. If that stat is a 1, or if it's a multiplier, the child will be in trouble, even though you might not have been. This condition, having the same genetic code on both copies of a chromosome, is called homozygosity. Humans. In humans, probably the most common genetic disorder caused by inbreeding is spinal muscular atrophy, SMA. SMA causes the death of the cells in the spinal cord and is often fatal or severely disabling. About 1 in 50 people have this abnormality, which means 1 in 100 people will contribute it to their children, and therefore 1 in 10,000 people, 100 times 100, will inherit the defective gene from both parents. Some forms of SMA are actually caused by a defect in 2 genes, so in practice, the statistical picture is a little more complicated. If a parent has a child with his or herself, on the other hand, the chance of SMA is 1 in 400. Since, if he or she has a copy of the defective gene, 1 in 100, there's a 1 in 4 chance it will be the child's only copy. 1 in 400 may not sound so bad, but SMA is only the start. DNA is complicated. DNA is source code for the most complex machine in the known universe. Each chromosome contains a staggering amount of information, and the interaction between DNA and the cell machinery around it is incredibly complicated, with countless moving parts and mousetrap-style feedback loops. Even calling DNA source code sells it short. Compared to DNA, our most complex programming projects are like pocket calculators. In humans, each chromosome affects many things through a variety of mutations and variations. Some of these mutations, like the one responsible for SMA, seem to be entirely negative. The mutation responsible has no benefit. In our D&D system, it's like a chromosome having a strength of 1. If your other chromosome is normal, you'll have a normal character stat. You'll be a silent carrier. Other mutations, like the sickle cell gene on chromosome 11, can provide a mix of benefit and harm. People who have the sickle cell gene on both their copies of the chromosome suffer from sickle cell anemia. However, if they have the gene on just one of their chromosomes, they get a surprise benefit, extra resistance to malaria. In the D&D system, this is like a 2x multiplier. One copy of the gene can make you stronger, but 2 copies, double multipliers, lead to a serious disorder. These 2 diseases illustrate one reason that genetic diversity is important. Mutations pop up all over the place, but our redundant chromosomes help blunt this effect. By avoiding inbreeding, a population reduces the odds that rare and harmful mutations will pop up at the same place on both sides of the chromosome. Inbreeding coefficient. Biologists use a number called the inbreeding coefficient to quantify the percentage of someone's chromosomes that are likely to be identical. A child from unrelated parents has an inbreeding coefficient of 0, while one who has a completely duplicated set of chromosomes has an inbreeding coefficient of 1. This brings us to the answer to the original question. A child from a parent who self-fertilized would be like a clone of the parent with severe genetic damage. The parent would have all the genes the child would, but the child wouldn't have all the genes of the parent. Half the child's chromosomes would have their partner chromosomes replaced by a copy of themselves. This means the child would have an inbreeding coefficient of 0.5. This is very high. It's what you would expect in a child of three generations of consecutive sibling marriages. According to D.S. Falconer's Introduction to Quantitative Genetics, an inbreeding coefficient of 0.5 would result in an average of a 22-point reduction in IQ and a 4-inch reduction in height at age 10. There would be a very good chance that the resulting fetus would not survive to birth. This kind of inbreeding was famously exhibited by royal families attempting to keep their bloodlines pure. The European House of Habsburg, a family of European rulers from the mid-second millennium, was marked by frequent cousin marriages, culminating in the birth of King Charles II of Spain. Charles had an inbreeding coefficient of 0.254, making him slightly more inbred than a child of two siblings, 0.25. He suffered from extensive physical and emotional disabilities and was a strange and largely ineffective king. In one incident, he reportedly ordered that the corpses of his relatives be dug up so he could look at them. His inability to bear children marked the end of that royal bloodline. Self-fertilization is a risky strategy, which is why sex is so popular among large and complex organisms. Well, one of the reasons. There are occasionally complex animals that reproduce asexually. Tremblay's salamander is a hybrid species of salamander that reproduces exclusively by self-fertilizing. These salamanders are an all-female species and, strangely, have three genomes instead of two. To breed, they go through a courtship ritual with male salamanders of related species, then lay self-fertilized eggs. The male salamander gets nothing out of it. He's simply used to stimulate egg laying. But this behavior is relatively rare. It typically appears in environments where it's difficult to reproduce sexually, whether due to resource scarcity, population isolation, or overconfident theme park operators. Chapter 31. High Throw. Question. How high can a human throw something? Irish Dave on the Isle of Man. Answer. Humans are good at throwing things. In fact, we're great at it. No other animal can throw stuff like we can. It's true that chimpanzees hurl feces and, on rare occasions, stones, but they're not nearly as accurate or precise as humans. Antlions throw sand, but they don't aim it. Archerfish hunt insects by throwing water droplets, but they use specialized mouths instead of arms. Horned lizards shoot jets of blood from their eyes for distances of up to 5 feet. I don't know why they do this, because whenever I reach the phrase, shoot jets of blood from their eyes in an article, I just stop there and stare at it until I need to lie down. So, while there are other animals that use projectiles, we're just about the only animal that can grab a random object and reliably nail a target. In fact, we're so good at it that some researchers have suggested that rock throwing played a central role in the evolution of the modern human brain. Throwing is hard. Citation, my little league career. In order to deliver a baseball to a batter, a pitcher has to release the ball at exactly the right point in the throw. A timing error of half a millisecond in either direction is enough to cause the ball to miss the strike zone. To put that in perspective, it takes about 5 milliseconds for the fastest nerve impulse to travel the length of the arm. That means that when your arm is still rotating toward the correct position, the signal to release the ball is already at your wrist. In terms of timing, this is like a drummer dropping a drumstick from the 10th story and hitting a drum on the ground on the correct beat. We seem to be much better at throwing things forward than throwing them upward. Counterexample, my little league career. Since we're going for maximum height, we could use projectiles that curve upward when you throw them forward. The Aerobee orbiters I had when I was a kid often got stuck in the highest treetops, where they remained forever. But we could also sidestep the whole problem by using a device like this one. We could use a springboard, a greased chute, or even a dangling sling. Anything that redirects the object upward without adding to or subtracting from its speed. I ran through the basic aerodynamic calculations for a baseball thrown at various speeds. I will give these heights in units of giraffes, with the standard giraffe standing 5 meters tall. The average person can probably throw a baseball at least 3 giraffes high. Someone with a reasonably good arm could manage 5. A pitcher with an 80-mile-per-hour fastball could manage 10 giraffes. Aroldis Chapman, the holder of the world record for fastest recorded pitch, 105 miles per hour, could, in